our reasons, and it makes us dynamic.
Okay, we're ready.
Okay.
To have each of us have a perspective. There you go.
All right, I'm going to start. Good afternoon. Today is November 5th, 2025, and I call to order this hybrid public meeting of the Clark County Developmental Disability Advisory Board. My name is Bob Friedland, serving as acting chair of today's meeting. This meeting is being held in person in room 210A of the Clark County Community Services Building and remotely as a hybrid meeting for remote participants. This meeting is being recorded in audio-only format, and today's recording will be placed on our public website. I'm pleased to report that we have a quorum and can take action on a number of important issues that will be discussed today. Do we want to put the agenda on the screen?
Yes. Yeah, I can share the agenda.
All right, we're going to pull up the agenda, and what we are going to be showing is our order of business for today's meeting. So I'm going to quickly discuss each of the agenda items for those joining us with only an audio connection.
Okay, sorry. I'm almost there.
You're doing a great job.
Okay, share.
Bob, I appreciate you reading the agenda.
There we go.
This is a great way to universally design our meetings as an accessibility feature for a lot of different needs. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. So the order of business is first we're going to be starting with community input, and that'll be an opportunity for people to talk about issues that are related to developmental disabilities but comes from the community as well as our board members. So we're going to start with board members first and then invite people from the community to be able to add to that community input. The special orders today include a conversation about Project Sidewalk, and we have two people, one from Public Health and one from University of Illinois, to talk about that with us. Following that, we're going to do a legislative update and hear from Addie. Are you here? Hi, how are you? You're going to join us at the table?
And, sure.
All right. And if Darla happens to be in there, that'd be wonderful as well. And then we're going to move on to legislative priority, and that requires an action from the board. And so we're going to share what we have. We are open to full conversation, so don't feel that you cannot change anything in that document. It is still in a draft form, and hopefully we can vote on that today. And the last is that one of our new members, Eva will be talking about emergency care for adults with IDD, then we will adjourn. So before we get started, we actually have our two new members in the room, and it'd be wonderful if we can turn to each of them and just have them state a few things about what brought them here and what your background might be. So I'll leave it to you to decide who should go first.
Hi, my name is Kelly Lindell. As he mentioned, I'm just new to the board. I'm excited to be here. I learned kind of about the board from being in leadership. Clark County graduated last year from that program, and it kind of worked out perfectly with my work life and my personal life. I work for CTRAN. I'm an assistant manager of operations for the C-Band Demand Response Service. So I worked for CTRAN for going on 25 years, been in the role that I'm currently in now for almost 3 years. So looking forward to seeing what I can bring to the board from my work perspective and also vice versa. I bring what I learned from the board to see how we can incorporate that in work. Also in my personal life, I have a daughter who is 25, and she has cerebral palsy. She's severe cerebral palsy. She's nonverbal, in a wheelchair, has a trach, uses a head switch to communicate. So she is my life and my world, and we've been in this world for 25 years, and it's amazing how much I've learned and I've grown in that time frame, and how much more I can still learn and grow as she gets older and reaches her different stages of life. So that's a little bit about me, and I'm excited to be here.
Fantastic.
Hey, hi everyone, I'm Eva Lucchini. I am an estate planning and special needs planning attorney in Camas, and my passion is serving the disability community. I've been a part of that community since my kids came my way, and I did a leadership training and advocacy program with Darla back in the day and Sandy Silveria, and that brought me into this community even more because I needed the help for my own family. And then they said, you know, you're not just advocating for your kids, we're advocating for all of them. And so I was very inspired. Now I'm part of a disability coalition that's forming, that's trying to pull together different resources. I just love to help in any way I can with the vantage point of an attorney who's serving both individuals that experience life with disability and the family members that love them, and how do we make sure their lives are as good as possible and that they can thrive. And I want to be part of finding solutions. So that's why I'm here.
Fantastic. All right. Shall I continue?
Sure.
All right. So for members of the public attending both in person and remotely, one of our first orders of business is to welcome community input. For those in the room, please wait to be recognized. And for those logged on remotely, please wait to be recognized before unmuting your microphone. Starting with board members and staff, are there any community inputs you would like to share?
Randy has her hand up, and Toffee has her hand up online.
So we welcome both of you on mute and then take turns, or however you'd like to do it.
Hi, everybody. I guess mine connected quicker. I was able to attend the Miss Clark County event this weekend, and I've never been a pageant mom. But I wanted to share with you that the young woman who was selected as Miss Clark County has a disability and uses a glitter cane. And it was such an amazingly inclusive, wonderful event. I just thought I would share that with you.
Oh, great.
And Taffy, you are you unmuted?
I am. Hi, everyone. My name is Tavi Mohing. I am one of the board members with Developmental Disabilities Administration, and I'm also an employee of DSHS Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. I'm the supervisor in the Vancouver DBAR office, and I wanted to just give a quick update of some changes that's happening in our agency. Back on October 30th, there was an email that was sent out by DVR Communications. It was sent out to community partners and also to CRP's Community Rehabilitation Program. And it talks about that DVR will be under order of selection. We've been under order of selection for a few months now, and at that time, we were only serving customers priority one, priority two, or category one and category two. Customers that were in eligibility category 3 to 5, they were put on a wait list. But effective December 8th, all categories will be put on a wait list. So that means that anybody that applies for DVR services and are eligible for services under category 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 will all be put on a wait list. We're doing this because there's limited resources right now. So again, that's going to be effective December 8th. All categories will be closed. I do encourage, you know, customers to continue applying for DVR services. Yes, they will be, you know, be determined eligible for services and they will be put on a wait list, but state office headquarter, they will determine when customers will be put, will be taken off the wait list, and the determining factor will be based on disability categories and also on application dates. So even though, you know, you apply and you're going to be put on a wait list, but the sooner that you apply and be determined is when, you know, we will follow the application date to be released off the wait list. We are still serving pre-transition students, we call it pre-employment transition services students ages 14 to 22. So if you have students, you know, please encourage them to apply if they're ready to, you know, to move forward with DVR. We help with a lot of different services as a student. We help with self-advocacy, job exploration, work-based learning. There's a couple more things. There's a total of 5. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but I encourage all students to continue applying and all customers to apply. We do have an information session that will be facilitated by Washington State Rehabilitation Council, WSRC, and that is a public forum. It's a virtual meeting on November 13th at 10:30. That is when our director, Dana Feld, she will be, you know, sharing this information and more information, and she will be there to help answer any questions. So I encourage everyone to attend this. It's again, November 13th at 10:30, and I can put the link to it in the chat. If there's anything else I wanted to talk about. So yes, that's all I have. It's, you know, it's unfortunate times, obviously, but that we, it's, you know, something that we have to do. So, yeah.
I just wanted to say that we can put that link with our meeting materials on our website too. So if you go to our advisory board. So yeah. Just for the people that are here in the room that we don't see the chat right now, because I'm sharing screen.
All right. Are there any other hands up in the space? Otherwise, I'll turn to the room here, because we do have a board member here with a comment. Eva?
Yeah, so I'm thinking about the DVR services basically becoming a no-paid caseload. In my mind, that's how it translates. And I'm thinking that DDA job coaching services don't start till 21. So now we have a pretty big gap. And it makes me further think of single parents of adult children with disabilities. And something that I learned, which is 11 other states have it such that in a divorce proceeding, the non-custodial parent, usually dad, has to continue child support of a disabled child after the age of 18. So the court can say, your child support continues after your kid turns 18. Right when we would want our kid to get the DVR services that are now not gonna happen for a bit. I would love to see, if anyone else cares about this issue, I think it would be pretty neat if Washington joined those 11 other states and required absentee parents to pay child support for their adult child after age 18, and how much better it would make the life of that mother and adult child with disabilities.
And are there any other comments from the board? All right, and we do communicate with each other at odd times between our meetings, so we'll have that as an opportunity for other people to comment on that as well. I now want to turn to community members. Do we have any community members online that would like to contribute information about events or other aspects of important messaging to this board? All right. If we did miss you, feel free to unmute at this point.
Oh, Gabriella raised her hand.
Oh, good.
Hi, sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry, I could not raise my hand fast enough. I'm driving. I do want to mention an event coming up on the 25th of this month is a community event for the Board Plane Corridor, and this is a Soul Food Fiesta. Several organizations are coming together. This is our third year that we do this, third time that we do a Soul Food Fiesta. It's a celebration for the community. We have food baskets and free food to eat in the at their location, and also music and games, and it's just a time for community, all community, to come together and be together and share some food. I'll be cooking something that day, like I do every time, so if you dare to show up, be prepared to eat some Mexican food. And on the 27th, River City Church is hosting a brunch for all community in Vancouver, and this is tamales, Mexican tamales, rice and beans, and we usually have some kind of treat with that, like a dessert. And again, this is for the entire community from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. So as soon as I get the flyer, I'll send it to Trish so she can send it to everybody. Oh, thank you.
Sounds good. When was that Fourth Plane Fiesta?
So it was Fiesta. It's on the 25th. And that will be from 5 to 8 at the Fourth Plane Community Conference.
And this is okay. 2 days. Is it one day?
I usually make Mexican pozole. Because that's what they want me to do, to make. And it's not because it's my preference, because that's what they ask me to make every single time. And we usually have around 150, 180 people showing up. So with these times that we are having right now, families affected with the food stamps and whatnot, we don't know how many people will get on the 25th. But this is a free event for the community. Thank you.
I have one.
Okay.
Sorry.
Amy would like to add a comment to the conversation.
So sorry. Gabriella, I'm so glad you mentioned with the impact from SNAP benefits not being paid. I obviously I serve as a teacher, and it's concerning to me having families reach out, and I had a family reach out to double check that their child was still able to access free and reduced lunch meals, even when the SNAP benefits are not being paid. And so that's something we need to assure our communities. There are concerns that school meals for students who qualify for free and reduced lunches are being provided, but this is often insufficient for students with disabilities who may be able to, many of my students we can get them a meal, and it might not be palatable to them because of food jags or food preferences. So that's been a challenge in my classroom, making sure that even as we're utilizing the breakfast and the lunch that's provided at the school, being able to find meals or foods that they're interested in or comfortable eating. And so this is a compounded challenge for some of our families that I think we need to be aware of.
Do you think we'll have that link up? On that one PowerPoint has the links for the state and the for SNAP.
I can recipients. I can share that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you want the last slide?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I'll work on getting that pulled
okay.
up. And
okay.
I'll pull it up in just a minute. But I think Hattie also might have had a comment.
Yes. Did you want to come forward?
I'll stay here for right
okay.
now. I'll,
let's see I'll if leave. We can if I can move out of your way.
Yeah. So Patty Sigham with Peace Northwest, also a community member and mom. I have three things for this portion. First, I know that I have mentioned before, but Clark County, we are helping put on a conference on intellectual and developmental disabilities in the spring. And I have saved the date for you all. We have a date and a location, which was incredibly difficult to find. Are they still on there?
Everyone's still there.
They are. Okay. I just have to pull something up. So, yeah, they're still here.
I was like, oh, no.
You just can't see them on the screen right now.
So May 15th, 2026, at Clark College, main campus, just right down here. It is, check-in's going to begin at 8 a.m., probably program will start at 9. We are going to have a specific track that is going to be in Spanish only. So our Spanish speaking families will not have to access interpreters. We will have speakers that will speak their native language. And then we will have at least two other tracks for families, communities, and self-advocates. So that's exciting. Right now it's just called a conference. Clark County Conference on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. We're trying to think of a really fun name for it, but have not come up with one. Second, Eva mentioned...
What was the date again?
May 15th.
Okay.
Which is a Friday.
You said 8 to...
Like 8 to 5.
Okay.
We are going to work with the ESD and hope to get the credits, the teaching credits.
Clock hours.
Clock hours. Thank you. I was like, what is it called?
So good.
Yes. So that would be great. And then Eva had mentioned the Clark County Developmental or the Disability Coalition.
Coalition for Disability Services.
Thank
that's
you.
What it's called. I just looked it up.
We are having main problems. anyways, so that group meets a couple times per month. And this last, so not this Tuesday, but last Tuesday, we hosted it at Peace Northwest. And because of the food insecurity and everybody not being able to access their SNAP benefits, as a coalition, we have decided that we are going to do kind of a food drive at all of our different locations. And we have a recommended list of foods that might be more palatable for our community.
Yes.
So Peace Northwest is a drop site for food, as well as Stevens Place, Camus, Respite Relief, Stride Northwest, the Therapy Center, and many others. I think we have a flyer for that I can get sent out. So you all...
And the drive has started?
What's that?
The collection has started?
Yes.
And how do families connect with when they have a need?
So that is, we're hoping that families will see the flyer and call us directly.
Okay.
Or if this is something that you come across, you can connect to one of our agencies and we'd be more than happy to prepare food boxes or what have you. There's also some grocery stores, Winco, if anybody would like to donate monetarily. Winco is doing a family-friendly gift card where the gift card is only eligible on food and diapers. So if you would like to purchase one of those and drop them off at Peace Northwest or one of the other agencies, we'd be more than happy to get those out to families. And then my last thing, it actually just came on my radar right as I was leaving the office. Kathy Murahashi from the Arc of Washington sent out a link for a study that the Lori Institute on Disability Policy conducted, and it was examining barriers impacting access to to HCBS, so home and community-based services faced by people with disabilities and color, and how people of color that also have disabilities are like significantly more likely to be institutionalized. And they did a couple year long report and study on this, and I can also get that sent over so you guys can view it.
Thank you, Heavy.
Of course.
All right, in our agenda we'll have Patty telling us about some of the legislative priorities and noise that might be coming from Olympia. Are there any other community matters that anybody would like to share? I did want to just see if that link on that one PowerPoint is available. If you
yes.
don't have it, it's okay. But
I do. I can share it.
Good. Ah, all right. That's beautiful.
Let me see. I got to share it on Zoom, too, so let me...
Okay.
Share.
Fantastic. So this was just something that came in that in Clark County. So as you know, Meals on Wheels people includes Portland. But there are two links in the state of Washington that we should probably put onto and share on the web. The first one's Washington 211. And as you can see, it says for food listings and emergency services. And then food assistance during the shutdown page has even more details. I believe that might be more specific to Vancouver, but I'm not 100%. But it'd be nice if there was that opportunity. So I can send along the actual link of that food assistance during shutdown to everyone.
Yeah, we'll send that out and add it to our website.
Fantastic.
Sure. Yeah.
All right, so we can kill off that slideshow.
Okay.
And see everyone again, reemerge. All right, well, I'm going to now turn to our special orders. And I didn't see Amy or Kiana on the list of participants, so I'm not sure who
They're
might
here.
Be presenting.
Yeah.
But we're going to hear now about Project Sidewalk, from these two distinguished guests. It sounds like an amazing process to introduce an evaluation of things as simple as difficult intersections to interact with.
Good evening, everyone. I don't know if you can see me yet, but can you hear me at least? Great. My name is Amy Koski. I am the built environment coordinator.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, Amy. I realized that I still have something up on the screen, so they actually can't see you. I was looking at you on my
You have a lot going on over there.
Yes, I'm trying to do all the technical pieces here. Okay, so now we can see you and hear you. Thank you. Sorry about that. Thank you, Bob.
Wonderful. Thanks, Patricia. So I'm Amy Koski. I'm the Built Environment Coordinator with Clark County Public Health. Happy to be here this evening. And I'm just going to introduce our presenter tonight, but I just wanted to give a quick little intro to why we're here. So at Clark County, we have a group of regional partners who make up together. We make up the Walkability Action Institute local chapter, so to speak, where we come together from the Regional Transportation Council, Clark County, multiple departments within the county, and some transportation folks in the city of Vancouver. And we work on an action plan around walkability, movability, and bikeability in the county. And so through that Walkability Action Institute, we are part of a national network, actually. And so we have access to different information and resources, and one of the things that came our way recently was this opportunity to learn more about this service learning curriculum for middle and high school teachers who might be interested in introducing disability, accessibility, and design to their students through this Project Sidewalk effort. And so we have here tonight Kiana McKee-Steen. She is going to be presenting this project and sharing what it's all about. And Kiana is staying up extra late, or staying past work hours at least, I think, in Chicago. So we're really grateful for her being here tonight to share what the University of Illinois at Chicago has developed along with Project Sidewalk. So with that, I'll let Kiana share what she has to present.
Thank you, Amy, for the great introduction. Hello, everyone. My name is Kiana McKee-Steen. I am the research coordinator over at UIC under the Project Sidewalk grant. I'm going to share my screen and kind of introduce you to the program that we have. But before I do that, I want to do just a soft introduction to what Project Sidewalk is. So Project Sidewalk is an online tool used to collect data on the sidewalk conditions. They've been running since, I believe, 2016, and it's been launched all over the world, but we do a lot of our work in the U.S., and it was actually started in Washington by the University of Washington's Makeability Lab. So the work that we do with them is under Project Sidewalk's tool that they created. So I'm going to share my screen and go over our curriculum programs. And I'm always fighting with Zoom, so if you guys can let me know in some way that you can see my presentation.
We see it great.
Sounds good. Thank you. So this is a Project Sidewalk Inclusive Service Learning Curriculum Study. Yeah, see if it'll work. There we go. So as I said, I'm Kiana McKee-Steen. I also work with Jamie Van Esch, our research assistant, and then Dr. Yochai Eisenberg, who's our lead researcher. So just a little bit about our research. As you guys know, ableism is negative beliefs, stereotypes, and misconceptions, which are rooted in societal beliefs about what constitutes normal and acceptable bodies and ways of living, leading to prejudice, exclusion, and systemic oppression of people with disabilities from society. The built environment is designed often without considering people with disabilities. This presents barriers in the form of inaccessible buildings, public transportation, and pedestrian infrastructure and maintenance services. Due to the lack of accessibility, people with disabilities are socially excluded from the community, which reinforces beliefs that come from cultural discourse versus experience. One way to address ableism is to provide formal disability education curriculum. Hence the purpose of our research. Our research will explore the feasibility, educator usage, student outcomes, and community impact of the curriculum programs. So first we have the Project Sidewalk Service Learning Curriculum, which is a general education disability education curriculum. The second is the Social Action and Media Curriculum, a special education self-advocacy curriculum. And then lastly is our Inclusive Service Learning Curriculum, which is the combination of the Project Sidewalk Service Learning Curriculum along with the Social Action and Media Curriculum. Each curriculum is a service learning curriculum which focuses on disability, accessibility, sidewalk infrastructure, and data analysis, which culminates in an advocacy project. So this is research, so there is a bit of a timeline. At the beginning, it should take about 1 to 2 weeks to gather consent forms and take a little survey just so we kind of know where students are coming from and their knowledge of the sidewalk. And then there is the curriculum delivery, which should run about 6+ weeks. It just kind of depends on how the teacher decides to implement the program into their class. Lastly is our post-curriculum survey and virtual focus group, which will run about 1 to 2 weeks, primarily for the instructor. Our research requirements, we need a letter from the administrator approving participation in the curriculum, consents and assents from students and parents, completion of the pre and post survey, and then again that participation in the post-curriculum focus group for the instructor. So I'm going to go over each of the programs just a little bit. So the service learning curriculum for general education, it's each curriculum is 6 modules. So for the first module in this curriculum, students will be introduced to disability etiquette, disability laws, and how inaccessible design affects people with disabilities. Students will be exposed to the lived experiences of people with disabilities and identify sidewalk barriers and practice virtual neighborhood navigation. In the second module, students will explore sidewalk features and careers in accessible urban design. Students will identify barriers, perform an optional walk audit, learn the project sidewalk tool labels, and develop inquiry and analysis skills. The third module, students will use a project sidewalk tool to virtually label sidewalk features and generate data. The fourth module will focus on validating data and analyzing complex sidewalk data patterns. The fifth module, students will analyze their data that they created and explore data visualization as a storytelling method for different audiences. And then their last module, students will plan and implement advocacy projects with an emphasis on resource gathering, persuasive presentation skills, and measuring outcomes using the 10 steps of advocacy. Now on to our social action and media curriculum. Their first module, they'll learn about the disability rights movement and the ADA. They'll understand accessibility barriers and enablers and sidewalks. They'll gain photography skills, storytelling skills, and a reflection to document accessibility issues. In the second module, students will build their vocabulary around accessibility to identify and analyze sidewalk features affecting mobility and strengthen communication through photo voice focus groups and presentations to their peers. In the third module, they'll apply their observation and data collection skills through walk audits and compare issues found during their audits with Project Sidewalk's online gallery to reinforce their advocacy with evidence. In the fourth module, they'll explore, they'll explore careers in accessibility and advocacy and develop professional skills through interviewing local advocates and reflecting on their personal strengths. In the fifth module, they'll define self-advocacy and practice using their personal voice to express their needs and ideas. They'll create media cards in the form of a story card to convey their personal experience and advocacy messages. And then they'll build their confidence in communication and storytelling for change. Their last module, they'll plan, script, and produce advocacy messages in the form of a video, slideshow, or poster, whichever one the student's comfortable with. And they'll conduct a final walk audit to capture supporting media and present their work to their peers, family, and community while reflecting on their growth as an advocate. Since we offer the opportunity for general education teachers and special education teachers to collaborate, I'm going to go over in the next couple slides what they'll be doing if they collaborate. So in module one, if they do the inclusive service learning curriculum, all students will participate in a, And I do want to mention that if they're doing the inclusive service learning curriculum, they'll still be doing each curriculum program separately. It's just going to be opportunities for them to come together and do different activities. So for module one, all students will participate in a gallery showing the photographs that the special education students took and engage in conversation about photos and experiences. In the second module, special education students will be able to share their stories that accompany their photographs, and general education peers will be able to provide feedback. For module three, general education and special education students will partner to perform a walk audit in the community and document the experience with photo voice. In the fourth module, students will partner and review each other's data. In the fifth module, students will work together to incorporate each other's data and storytelling into their own projects. And then in the last module, they'll plan and create an advocacy project together using the data from each classroom and have an opportunity to showcase their projects to each other and the community. So again, this is just our contact information. And that is my presentation. Are there any questions? Randy?
This is wonderful. Forgive me, I'm a little confused though. These are existing students at the University of Chicago, or these are students all over, or, because like my daughter has autism, but her partner has CP, so she's had a lot of experience of places they can't go together. And she's graduating college in December, and she would love to do something like this, and I'm just curious how you can access this, how, like, who the participants are.
Yeah. Congratulations to your daughter.
Thank you.
No problem. So the curriculum programs themselves can be launched at any school transition program, workforce development program throughout America. Essentially, all they have to do is sign their permission to participate in the research, and then they would just kind of run it through their program. However, that's not the only way a community can get involved. I know right now, Vancouver, Washington is showing up on Project Sidewalk because the community has to be open on the map. We are currently running or testing our beta AI to support communities and validations because, you know, everyone's generating all that data, and in order to use it, it has to be validated. So to support communities, especially smaller communities, we're trying to test run AI to support the validating of the data. However, to answer your question, it can be done anywhere throughout the U.S.
That's fantastic. You may have an applicant in a few months. Thank you.
No problem.
Amy?
I was going to say, I don't think my name's on the screen. That was a fabulous presentation. I am a public education teacher, and I just think about what are the lessons that help promote self-advocacy and help promote, I think, career exploration and helping young folks in understanding their opportunity to be change makers. And when I think about careers of the future, I think universally designing our spaces and creating accessible spaces is a robust opportunity. And I think a lot of people just can't yet see the potential for them to be able to notice a challenge and make a change. So I think this addresses at a lot of different areas where I can see students learning the skills of research and learning the skills of advocacy, and learning, I think, a lot about themselves. And there really is a social justice aspect that is baked in to the entire lesson. So I also, like Randy, I'm like, oh my goodness, this is amazing, and it exists. So thank you for staying up late to tell us about it.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that you support the work that we're doing.
I have a question.
Yes.
So are you looking, hi, Trish, over here. So are you looking to enroll schools? So you're trying to get the word out about this project? And if so, what are the timeframes that you're kind of looking to enroll schools or programs?
Yeah, we are actively recruiting all teachers, special education, social studies teachers, computer science. And our hope is to get our recruitments done by the end of the year so programs can start in the springtime. That way you have enough time to comfortably move through the curriculum and you don't feel rushed. The nice thing about the curriculum itself, for both curriculums, there are parts built in that need to be done in order for the students to really generate that data and notice the change that they're making. But there are optional activities for teachers to continue if the teachers are, you know, interested, or the students are interested in doing different activities. So we try to make it as flexible as possible for teachers to implement.
Randy?
Sorry, me again. I worked for cities for almost my entire career. Is there any chance we could include urban planners in the community the schools are in so that we can see something really, because they would learn from this curriculum too, and we might get faster action on some of this stuff. You know, everybody's got their ADA compliance person, But if you have a real community development person participating, it might be worth seeing if you can get one, because that's really where the changes are made.
Yeah, that's kind of how I met Amy.
Yeah.
Specifically the area of Vancouver.
Yeah, I guess I'll add that I work with planners at the county. I am a planner by training. I'm in public health, but I'm a planner by training. And so we haven't figured out exactly how far this will go, but that this was kind of the first stop when we heard that this advisory board might be interested in hearing about it. And so, you know, if there's a school that decides to participate or community members, I know I'll be able to hear as people sign up from Kiana, and then we can figure out ways to collaborate. I see that this would really be a way to share the knowledge that the community and the students and just interested community members find, and it could help us enhance our data and kind of build advocacy for youth within some of our other commissions, like the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee, for example. So I think there's lots of exciting opportunities, I'm happy to be kind of a connection point, if that's helpful, from the county.
And then just to mention the power of the students themselves, we did the service learning curriculum for general education students here in Illinois, Mendota, Illinois. The students, 7th, 8th grade, and high school students, social studies teachers, ran the curriculum with their students. And from the work that their students did, the data collection, validating each other's work, and producing those advocacy projects, they managed to secure 2 grants for the community to improve sidewalks. They received the Safe Routes to School grant and the Ruby Bridges grant. So they are working on improving their sidewalk conditions, and a lot of their community didn't have sidewalks to begin with, so implementing those sidewalks in.
Kelly, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, with me working for CTRAN and just to hear all the data that you can collect through this program, and you know, we're doing the Vine on Highway 99 and trying to get all those stops to be accessible. Plus we have many other various stops here and there throughout the county that are not accessible, and we are working on upgrading those stops to be accessible. And just to know that there's this program that maybe at some point our planning department with CTRAN could work and collaborate and get that information to make what our planners do a little easier, because your group has already done the legwork, and to know that they had a part in making their public transportation whole would be really cool.
And then I do want to make note, this is a free program. I know that comes up a lot. It's free to participate. It's free to use Project Sidewalk. And the data that's collected is completely accessible for everyone. There's no request that you have to make to access data. It's all downloadable from the website, which I'll be placing in the comments, are the Project Sidewalk website itself, and then our Accessible Communities website, which goes into, you know, how to get involved for teachers, workforce development professionals, community groups, and then the community itself, planners.
Fantastic. Are there any other questions from the audience? Well, thank you, Amy and Kiana, for sharing this important information with us. Thank you again
for
coming. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we turn to Hattie, and I hope I'm not I want to make sure that it's just you speaking today. Okay. And we're going to hear about legislative updates prior to the start of the 2026 60-day short session. The even years don't have as many legislative priorities. They're really working on budget adjustments and addressing various policy issues. So let me hand the floor to you.
Hey, well, thank you again so much for letting me join you. Just really quick, Trish, I forwarded you an email from Secretary Honesten from DCYF, and she has a lot of resources compiled in that email for the federal shutdown and for housing and food and lots of great things in there if you want to share in the notes. Okay, so a few things. Trish had asked if Darla and I could prepare kind of an overview of what we are looking at during the legislative session coming up in January, as well as some of the federal updates as far as we know. I don't know if you've all heard, but the federal government is shut down. So no updates, unfortunately. I did see right before I headed over here that members of both sides are saying that they are making some progress, and they're hoping the Senate will agree to stay in session and negotiate through the weekend instead of calling it quits tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Also, I did hear from the Department of Health that they have funding for WIC through November. Originally, they had said through mid-November, and now they are saying through November, so that's good. And then as far as Washington State, an organization, or not an organization, a group that I participate in called Community Advocacy Coalition is really takes the lead on planning like the legislative advocacy days that we do. And there are over 50 groups and organizations that participate in this statewide group. And all through the summer and into early fall, we've been working on not our priorities per se, but kind of doing a poll of the priorities of the different organizations that participate and agencies. We have counties, we have DDA come every month, we have parent coalitions and self-advocacy groups, and a ton of disability related services that participate. And the four that were bubbling to the top were no cuts to services, progressive and alternative revenue for DD services, ending isolation and restraints, and protecting immigrant and refugee families with IDD, which I'm glad that this is the first year that we've only had four that we can agree on. Anyway, so on September 15th, the Department of Social and Health Services submitted its proposed 2026 supplemental budget to the Office of Financial Management. This includes the proposed budget for Home and Community Living Administration. HECLA is now their acronym. This step is part of the regular state budget process, but this year's proposal is especially significant because of the tight fiscal environment. HECLA's requests are focused on sustaining critical services, not expanding them, especially considering unpredictable state and federal resources. Some fiscal challenges include demand for service continues to rise. The cost of providing those services keeps increasing. Forecasted state revenues are declining, and at the federal level, the passage of HR 1 has reduced federal funding. And again, we have no funding at the moment. Because of these combined challenges, HECLA's 2026 supplemental budget request is limited. It prioritizes maintaining essential programs and workforce support rather than adding new initiatives. So some of the key asks in their budget request is reimagining DSHS at no cost. I'm sure a lot of you noticed that DDA is now not called DDA. I always get it wrong. Department, no, what is it?
Developmental
Disabilities Community Services. Yes. Not to be confused with the county. Developmental Disability Community Services.
We're the Developmental Disabilities Program at Clark County.
Okay.
In the Department of Community Services. So, yeah, not confusing at all,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Not at all. So, yeah, that launched in May 2025.
Yeah.
So it basically put aging and long-term support and developmental disabilities and Behavioral Health Administration were all reorganized into two divisions. One is Home and Community Living Administration, HECLA, and the other is Behavioral Health and Rehabilitation Administration, EHHA. Blah. this is a no-cost proposal, so yay. Developmental Disability Community Service financial eligibility staff, they're asking for temporary funding for eligible staff, eligibility staff, because that did end. And without adding to this, the caseload ratio for eligibility will go from 1 to 952 to 1 to 1,714. So almost doubling. So obviously leading to delays and backlogs in financial eligibility processing, which is already taking an exorbitant amount of time. We have families that were deemed eligible for DBA, or, you know, whatever it's called
now.
DBCS.
Yes.
In January that are still waiting on their financial eligibility and assessments today. So 10 months at least. They also are asking for legal support for long-term care residents. So legal support for Medicaid residents on long-term care facilities who face involuntary discharge. Telecommunication equipment for the deaf and hard of hearing. And the Dan Thompson Community Grant, so fund $2 million into the Dan Thompson Endowment Trust. We are also working on meeting with our legislators. The 17th Legislative District will be meeting on November 17th at Compass Coffee in Washougal. I believe it is 10:30 a.m. We will have all three of our legislators in attendance. And then the 20th LD is meeting December 16th at 4:30 p.m.
Wait.
Oh, I'm sorry.
November 16th?
December 16th.
December 16th. Okay, sorry.
It's not 4:30. It is, let me just double check. So yeah, December 16th at 1 p.m. and at Seasons Coffee in Richfield. The 18th LD is meeting at 4:30, but the date is to be determined. They gave us three dates. But it will be in December.
Okay.
And then the 49th, yes, is just a big question mark because nobody wants to get back to us. But we'll plan it with or without them, and we'll get our community members together and have a conversation and say, hey, you missed us. So that's all I have for right now.
Thanks, Patty.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Any questions to Hedy?
Never remember what LD I'm in because I changed.
We can.
I mean, I'm just in 17. That was.
Yeah,
I was gonna say. I bet you're 17.
I can never keep it straight. Okay.
So that's December 17th
at Compass Coffee, Washington.
November
17th. Oh, that one's November 17th, 11-17 in the 17th.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Well, thank you very much, Hattie. This is wonderful to hear. Do you think that these coffee clutch opportunities are the ones that we should also target as a prelude to them heading to Olympia?
I mean, yes. Any opportunity to get your legislator is, you know, a good opportunity. They've all told us that they'll be there for an hour. So we'll have at least an hour of their time. I will say the last time we met with the 17th in person, with all three of them, we were there for almost 2 hours and we had a fantastic conversation. One last thing, because of scheduling the conference, I actually also got the candidates forum scheduled for next year, and it will be on October 22nd at Geyser Hall. At Clark College, and it usually starts at 5:30 p.m. And yeah, don't want to think about it yet, but here we are.
Save the date.
Yeah, save the date.
Alrighty. So moving on, if it's fine with everyone, I want to move on to, this is actually a wonderful opportunity for us to segue into our next order of business. Each year, our advisory board develops, discusses, and approves a written document outlining our legislative priorities. The subcommittee taking on our legislative priorities this year included Gabriella, Randy, and myself, with Trish helping us to stay positive in light of the many budget pressures facing legislators in 2026. Our subcommittee felt that our first priority this year would be to press legislators to maintain and protect existing funding streams in Washington State. So our first paragraph, you'll notice in our draft, acknowledged the reality of the federal funding changes and increased pressures on state budget, and emphasizes our main priority to ensure that people with IDD continue to live, work, and participate fully in community life. At this point, let me ask Randy and Gabriella to step forward and encourage a full conversation about this document.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part of your sentence.
Well, I just want you to lead the full, to get everyone on the advisory board to present their views and comment on anything they feel is missing or overstated or anything else that might come up.
I think I was really pleased with what we went through. I don't know that there's anything I would add beyond what we've got. Has everyone had a chance to read it? Does anyone have any questions? Gabriella, anything?
Hi, everyone. I'm sorry I have my camera off, but I'll show you. It's too dark to even see.
Oh, wow.
We can see a shadow.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where I have my camera off. Well, first of all, thank you, Bob, Trish, and Randy for putting us together for these priorities and for helping us to stay positive. That's a good one. I'm sorry. I'm just going to say that for everything that is coming in our way with Medicaid, ads and whatnot, we thought about just asking for no cuts to our services, and I know that the legislature is having issues with their budget, so it will be great just to have no budget cuts. I don't know if any of you have any thoughts about the document, if you had the opportunity to read it like Randy was mentioning it will be great, but we would love to get your input.
We try to focus on things that don't necessarily cost money this year, just policies that we can look to, such as, you know, restraint and seclusion, things that we can work on that don't necessarily require a bunch of cash up front because we know how limited we are. But if everybody's comfortable with it and we don't have a lot of questions, you know, I'd love to make a motion that we accept it and get on it and start sharing it, especially at these upcoming LD meetings that Patty was sharing with us. So moved, if that's okay.
I want to just recognize Eva. Go ahead.
Hi. This shows so much work and so much effort, and I'm really excited to see this document. I have one thing that I would like to add, and at some point it will cost money, but not at the jump, and that's at the very end when we talk about developing services for aging adults with IDD who have aging caregivers. And I call it the problem of the last man standing. And it's the problem that every single parent of a kid, or especially an adult with IDD, that's what keeps them up at 3 at night. And it's the idea that when I die, or as a lot of my clients say, if I die, what happens to my kid? And they think that a sibling's going to take care of them, or a certain person is going to be able to take care of them. But what if this person with disabilities outlives everybody, and they don't have the funds to pay for a private, for a certified professional guardian? It's a problem that I see. It's a problem that no one's talking about because no one realizes it might happen. It might be coming down the pike. So it's not going to be something on the survey that people are thinking of, but it's still something we need. And the ARC had a very small guardianship of last resort program, too small, and they disbanded it this past year, or last year, sort of quietly, and it wasn't enough to begin with, but we still need something here. So what I would like to add is a sentence at the end of this wonderful paragraph that reads something like this: explore the creation and funding of a Clark County guardianship of last resort for guardianship, conservatorship, representative payee, and agency under powers of attorney for IDD individuals, or perhaps we just want to say DDA clients, with no assets to pay for professional fiduciaries and no appropriate family to serve in that role. It's something that it exists in other counties. I don't have a countywide or statewide understanding, but this is something we need to explore for our families in our county. And we need, start some kind of exploration of it at the very least.
I have a question. Isn't it the court that assigns somebody paid by the county when there's no assets in the family?
No. The court doesn't do that. What they do is they hope that, and I've seen this in my practice, what they're hoping is a certified professional guardian, usually a newbie, will take on this person. And the way that they get paid is through Medicaid participation. And it's $230 a month or something like that, which is why experienced professional guardians that have a full docket, they don't have time for this. It's going to be somebody new, and they're going to have a huge docket, and they're taking on these Medicaid people, and they can't really devote much time for $230 a month. Moreover, they only get that $230 a month payment if the person lives in a certain residential setting. So if they live in a supported living environment or they live in their own home, this guardian would have to move them. But we don't have enough people to do it to begin with. It's basically, no, the court does not find someone for you. They don't. They just hope that somebody will step in and take this very low-paying matter.
So, just to be clear, you're saying this is happening in other counties in Washington State, but not in Clark County?
Other counties have a guardianship of last resort.
Okay. And so we need the state to, like, if we take these legislative priorities to Olympia, this is something that we need the state to address specifically, or is this something that happens in the county? Like, I understand, how will the state help us, or are they going to be like, that's a county problem? Look at how Snohomish County, or look at how King County, or look, like, I want them to help us, but I just want to know, like,
I don't have the answer to that, but I figure either way, we're the only people to have eyes on this problem.
Right. And
if I
what county
just
gets,
from my background,
yeah.
If we were to advocate to the state for this, we would have to get the Association of Counties and a lot of people on board. We might have counties saying, oh, that's an unfunded mandate, we're not going to do it. I think the most effective approach may be to talk to our county council as a start, given the environment that we're currently in. And it would be a big lift at the county level. We'd have to work on that. I mean, at the state level, I think if we can keep it here, maybe find, you know, funding sources and other things, we'd be in better shape. But that's just my quasi-professional opinion. Anyone?
I think if we get people talking about it on any level, that's going to set it for a priority for the future, even at the state level. But I truly have not done the research. I don't know how other counties are doing this. I just know that we were, and we're not anymore. And I want it back and grown for my...
And I will say that the county never has done a guardianship of last resort. The county didn't have, you know, we didn't fund that. So that has not typically been what the county has funded. I think that, you know, the ARC was doing it and trying to kind of fund it based on what they could capture and in fees. So, you know, we did have the ARC, we had an organization that did it, and it would be my guess that other communities have similar situations where there might be an organization that has kind of taken this on. I think that it would be worth talking with the Developmental Disabilities Administration too. I don't think we have anybody here tonight, but occasionally we do. About how this works for, you know, people in other communities and what's happening. Do they know what's happening for people that need guardians here?
Right. Because this is an issue, but I also wonder, like, how is it happening other places? So maybe our advocacy would be broader. Like, how we can't expect this to be happening through organizations and nonprofits. Like, if this is a systemic challenge, it can't be fixed with people doing benevolence work and soaking up their budgets. Like, this should be a state priority addressed for all counties if that's the need. And if some counties are having it, is it fully addressing the need? Who is paying for that? Could that, like, I just think there is a bigger, if we're seeing a problem, how is it getting fixed other places, and do they need help?
I guess, this is Gabriela, I guess we have some homework to do. If you know, Eva, if you know the counties that have these resources, maybe you can share what counties are those, and we can take on, like, each of us calling in different, each county. So it's not all on one person to find out how do they do this process and how did they get there, to learn more how we can request something for Clark County. I don't know. That's just my thought. I don't know.
There is something at the state level. There's just no one doing it in Clark County. That was what I had heard. So there is something at the state level. There's no one implementing it here. But I can research that, I can find that out, and I can let you know. I just don't want to lose the opportunity to have it be, if it is a state level thing, to lose the opportunity to have it be part of this document, because it really is part of that last bullet point.
Yes, right.
I think we could go ahead and add a more general statement since we still have more research to do, but explore the creation of guardianship funding, guardianship of last resort funding for DDA clients, generalize. So it gives us the opportunity to start moving in that direction, and we can figure out whether it's something we can really push this year at the state level, or if we can start getting some movement at the local level too. Would that work for you, Eva?
Yes. What's my deadline?
Well, if you like that worded, we can sneak it into the document before we take a vote today. Would that be okay?
Right.
That'd be lovely.
Okay.
Okay, so will you say that again, Randy?
Explore the creation of a guardianship of last resort for DDA clients. Or however we refer to our folks in our community.
Well, for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah, exactly. And this way it's in there. It's not coming out of left field. We can start doing our homework, see what other counties are doing, see if there's any enabling state legislation that's out there that we're not familiar with yet, and, drive it home as the opportunities become available. If it's not a 2026, it might be a 2027, but I'm glad you brought it up and we can get it in there because it definitely fits in that last bullet. So
and it's a conversation we can be having with lawmakers who maybe have not read or heard that term before and starting to put that on their agendas as well, wanting to be curious about what's happening in their own communities.
Get it on their radar.
Yeah.
Yep. And I've been involved in advocacy for IDD for 20 years, and it's the first I'm hearing about it. So it seems very, very possible, especially in current circumstances. So thank you, Eva.
Yes, thank you.
All right, so we can add that to the document.
Mm-hmm. Yep. If there's a motion to add it with that statement.
So moved.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, okay.
Good job. I'm Sarah.
Sorry, Bob. You're the one that's supposed
perfect.
To ask for the motion. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So, given that we've just had a motion to approve this now modified document of the 2026 DDAB legislative priorities, which will be shared with legislators and other public officials throughout Washington State, shall we vote on that? Are there any last-minute comments that anyone would like to add before we vote?
I want to thank the Legislative Committee for working on this, and I appreciate the considerations given the current climate and just really being responsive to budgetary concerns and ensuring that our priorities center the needs we know we have, even as we're just trying to hold ground sometimes.
Fantastic. All right. If I may ask, all those that approve this document, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Wonderful. It passes today. The motion passes unanimously. Thank you all very much for that. All right. And our final order of business will be to discuss explicit state of Washington laws that is meant to prevent exclusion of guardians or those with established powers of attorney when seeking emergency care for adults and teens with IDD. There has been a disregard for this law in both Clark County and across the state. I'll now call on Board Member Eva to begin this discussion by sharing details about the law and the lack of compliance, and for the DDAB to forge a plan to to address this issue moving forward?
I'd be glad to. I didn't realize that I would be kind of preparing. I didn't prepare anything, but that's pretty much how I do things anyway sometimes. You know that I get a lot of calls from folks and sometimes from the folks at Peace that there's somebody in the hospital with IDD and their family members are just getting iced out by the medical team and they're very frustrated. And they may have a power of attorney under the supported decision-making paradigm, or they may have guardianship, conservatorship. Well, guardianship would be relevant here. And the medical team is just icing them out. We don't want to deal with you, and they want to. And or they may say that the individual says they don't want mom and dad to have anything to do with it, their care. And it's usually a mental health situation that got them in the ER. So I had a client. I've had several, but my most recent client is a young woman who just turned 18, and she is deaf, and she had a mental health issue. I did her powers of attorney, and I have permission from her to share about this. I did her powers of attorney saying that mom and dad have the authority to participate in her medical decision-making effective immediately. And they brought that to Peace Health, and Peace Health, I think, was pretty good for a bit. They had a translator. They had whatever she needed. And then in the middle of the night, they ferried her across state lines and put her in a facility in Oregon. Didn't ask parents. They don't even know how parents are going to pay for this. She's not on Medicaid yet. So the parents could not get any traction trying to find out. They said, here's where your daughter is now. And so they kept calling and calling. We have power of attorney. Can you talk to us? They would not talk to these parents at all. Turns out that, they were basically saying that the young woman didn't want mom and dad involved. But since they didn't have a deaf translator, I'm not sure how they really communicated well with her, and she's having a mental health episode anyhow. In the end, because I was their attorney, I contacted the facility and made some calls and faxed things and emailed things, and suddenly they called the parents and said, you can come pick her up, we're discharging her. And now they're just sending the bill. So this is unacceptable. If you have a power of attorney and you've given it to someone else and you're in the hospital, that person is allowed to speak for you if you can't speak. But apparently, if you are IDD, that doesn't work. And I don't know why that would be, other than it's much easier for the hospital to do what they need to do without having input from mom and dad saying, oh, she needs this or she needs that. I don't know. I have not been able to make any traction on my own talking to hospital representatives at all. So I bring this issue to you all because this is our county. These are our ERs, and these are our people. And so whatever, I'm not sure what steps to take. I really don't know. I just know I need somebody besides me to get in there and perhaps speak to the risk management people at the hospital. We just need the right, amount of star power.
Randy has her hand up.
You're muted still. Randy.
Sorry about that. I'm wondering if this might not be a great opportunity for us to do a local campaign and just send a letter of, hey, this is the law. We want you, and just start getting it out there just as a public information campaign to the hospitals. Work with the local hospital association. Make sure they know what the law is, and just make sure they know we're aware of what's been happening. So, just an idea.
I like that idea.
Gabriella?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Eva. Yes, I'm familiar with situations like that, and it is so bad that this happens. I am collaborating with the Washington courts for a little bit over 2 years for guardianship and the guardianship process. And instead of Washington, every county is different. And for doing that, I am aware that the court staff throughout the state of Washington doesn't even know what a term of supported decision making is, nor what the document or the purpose of that is. So I think that, and that's because even they told me that, the same court staff. They said, we don't even know that, because when my son was served a document to go and be a, I forget the word, when you have to go to court to decide in a case. What is it called?
A hearing?
A jury duty. Jury duty, yes.
Oh, jury duty.
Yes, and so I declined for my son to be there because he has a supported decision-making document and he cannot make a decision for somebody else, even unless for himself, right? And they wouldn't even understand that. So long story short, I think that Randy is in, I'm in the way, and the same thought as Randy, probably doing a campaign from the county, if Trish, if Vanessa, think it's okay to not only hospitals, but medical doctors, and even the court system in Clark County to be aware and that the law changed for support decision making to be more profound for individuals that don't need full support, but they still have that support from individuals that they choose to get that support. So they need to obey the law and respect it, and probably sending a document like that will be a wake-up call to say, if you send a bill to these people because you did what you did, then you have to pay for the bill. You know, this is just my thought, because they don't know what those words mean. They think parents just pull it out of their pocket and say, like, hey, I had a support decision making, but they really don't know what that is. That's my thought. I don't know.
No, it's 100% right. And what you're saying is you're expanding. I mean, this happens to people with guardianship papers as well, but it happens to people that choose supported decision making in lieu of guardianship. And you're right. Nobody knows what supported decision making means. And they don't want to obey it because they're used to thinking, hey, if you are cognitively disabled, you should have a guardianship. That is, and you still have attorneys, court visitors, they used to be called guardian ad litems, and judges who as well are like, oh, if you have a cognitive disability, then you need a guardianship. What? They don't know. The law changed in 2020 to bake in this alternative called supportive decision making. And they just don't understand how it works. So maybe we would do a lot of good for our families by just getting the word out as much as possible to the court, to the court, to the court visitors, to the guardianship bar as well. You're absolutely right. And then certainly to hospitals and doctors.
And the hospitals, I think it would be wise to have the walk and that they can, even if they have questions, to have their legal team and their legal team in their hospitals or whatever to go back into the walk and see about that document. Because when they take the liberty to move somebody across the state lines and then have two parents, and even more if parents tell them we have support decision making, and more now that since the law changed, there's more and more advocacy for no guardianship and support decision making for self-advocates, which is one of the items in the, with the CAC, to support more for support decision making than full guardianship, because that takes the rights and powers of people away in so many ways. Mm-hmm. So maybe listing the work on that document will be a the way to go and for them to be educated and to respect the law. It's just my thought.
Randy, did you had your hand up?
Yeah, I'm just thinking that, oh God, it just slipped out of my head. I apologize. It's been kind of a stressful 24 hours. That do we have a way of letting our clients know this and like creating a pamphlet that people get, as well as letting letting the hospitals and care providers know? And do we want to think about including this in our updated plan? Because just bringing it to people's attention that we need doctors and hospitals to pay attention to what is the current law, it might be worth it because that gets spread out so much. Or is it too late to add anything to the plan?
Oh, no, it's not too late to add anything to the plan. We're working on the plan, and y'all will see drafts and then hopefully be coming together in January to approve the plan. So we're doing a lot in between now and January. So it's not too late to include it in the plan for sure. And I guess I would just say that it's sounding like you all kind of want to pull together some information that we can get out to the community about this topic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would just ask that maybe there's a few of you, it seems like Gabriella and Eva, you're pretty knowledgeable about what the need is, what the concerns are, and then also really what the, you know, requirements and law is around this. And so, you know, maybe we can work on drafting something that then we can, you know, be able to share out, and y'all can, that can be something that y'all say, okay, we pulled together this information, and then we can be able to share it.
I have one.
Yes.
Additional comment. Sorry. I really appreciate you bringing this to our attention at the last meeting and then following up on this meeting. And I think about the challenges that the families who I serve experience in the getting medical care, and they are not, you know, they're younger children, so they're not dealing with guardianship yet. But I think even understanding the ableism that is persistent in the medical community, the misunderstanding of intellectual and developmental disabilities that requires a close collaboration with family members during diagnosis and treatment, not shoving family members away. Like, so understand, I think for me, this is, it just feels like good decision making. But I appreciate that we can help folks understand their obligation under the law, which this is.
If we could do this, a campaign, it's cost neutral. It's just our work. I definitely want to get the word out to people, but I also want to get the word out to the people, because, you know, at these hospitals, and that inroad, I don't know yet how to do, but we need to talk to the risk management people. We need to talk to some hospital VPs. We need to get their ear.
I also wonder about, like, just hospital boards in general. Like, they all have boards.
True.
And to understand that their employees, the boards are making final decisions on so many things, and they're the ones who need to guide their employees to follow the law.
Well, and we had public health here tonight, and I know Jan is with public health and with the children with special health care needs, so that's on the children's side. So that's probably pretty solidly, like, the parents are involved there, right? But I just wonder about, like, if public health could, you know, have us, help us navigate this, or, you know, just, we can ask them too.
Should we set up a subcommittee for that?
Yeah.
Would that be good?
Yeah.
All right.
What do you think?
So the suggestion is to possibly create a subcommittee to investigate and to start to collate some pretty heady issues, and to try and discover what's doable on the early side and what things need a little more help, and who we should be collaborating with, perhaps could be some of the focus of that subcommittee.
Pick me.
How this works.
Yeah. Fantastic. Who else would like to forward an opportunity to work on this particular issue?
This one I can help with. I'm probably just less knowledgeable, but I understand advocacy. Like, okay. I know how to go to the school board to make change. I can probably go to a hospital board and be like, okay, let's do this.
Let's get started. So we'll...
Okay. And when the board decides to do a subcommittee, usually I kind of help like with coordinating, scheduling, and then I can provide some staff support for y'all and you provide me with ideas and,
okay,
you know, what you want to see there. And then, we'll see who else, you know, we might be able to enroll, you know,
okay,
as well. So, yeah.
Does that sound?
So is this going to be part of the subcommittee for the legislative agenda or separate?
Separate. This is a subcommittee for the campaign to address,
educate hospital staff on the legitimacy of their obligation okay, legally.
Yes.
Okay. I can support that effort depending on the dates and times you guys meet. Thank you.
Okay, so you want to be on the subcommittee, Gabriella?
Yes, that's okay.
Okay, and it'll be depending on when all three of you are available. So there you go. That sounds great. Okay.
Oh, what a great ending to this meeting. Is there any other business for the good of the order? If not, I'd like to adjourn today's meeting. Thank you all very, very much.
Great.
Thank you.
Have a
Thank
lovely
you.
Evening.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.